listening to another Netcast production brought to you by the Fancy Pants Gangsters at fancypantsgangsters.com. Because those who can, do. Those who cannot, do it on the internet.
Some would say that spring is the time of renewal and new life, while fall is the season of calm reflection and a slowing of nature. Those people are not only wrong, but they are also probably communists. Freedom-loving people of the internet, welcome to the October 2010 edition of FancyPantsGangsters.com's very own Iwo Jima of movie netcast, The Film Army. This month on The Film Army, a wave of new recruits helps the beleaguered front lines get unleaguered. Friend of yet another gaming show, Ian Anderson, comes to the defense of Transformers 2, while fresh-faced private Nate Willer brings valuable foreign intelligence with his review of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Pants Commander Evan, widely considered the cuddliest military leader since George Patton, shows highlights from his interviews at the Chicagoland Entertainment Collectors Expo with Bond girl Carolyn Monroe and Star Wars actors Bonnie Peace and Gerald Holm. And Courtney celebrates the coming of football with a look at his favorite gridiron flicks. This announcer hopes he includes Little Giants, featuring twin acting legends Rick Moranis and Ed O'Neill. The Film Army would like to congratulate sponsor Netflix's recent charge into Canada. With your help, Canada's Maple Log Tanks and Moose Cavalry will be no match for this, the October 2010 edition of The Film Army.
Today, I'm going to defend a piece of shit. Kick back, watch it crumble. So today, the piece of shit I want to talk about is Transformers 2, Revenge of the Fallen. Now, before we really get into it, the first thing to note is that the budget was $200 million, and it made over $800 million in the box office. So it's not necessarily a bomb, but it did get panned in the reviews big time. Now, the first time I saw it, the first thing I thought to myself was, I can't think of this as a normal movie. It's like the movie was made for children, but just with more adult themes. You have to suspend that little bit of disbelief that you always hear with a lot of the fiction movies. But more so than that, you just have to think back to when you were a kid and you had Optimus Prime and you had Megatron in your hands, and you just sat there and fought with him. You just clashed them together, bang, 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 having fun. This movie starts with that bang. Right away, we get Transformers. Unlike the first one, we had to wait through a bunch of introduction to get to that. Now, before I blow my movie credibility out of the water trying to defend this piece of shit, one of my favorite movies of all time is American Beauty. I do love story, I do love interesting characters. But at the same time, I don't expect every movie to deliver that quality to me, those deep, rich characters, and that story that just picks you up and brings you into that world and delivers you an experience. This movie is, for me, is what I consider like almost like a throwaway movie for me. Something I can turn on in the background, and just sit down and watch it, maybe get some work done. And it's just fun. You know, you look up, see Transformers fight. Awesome. If the story moves by and you miss a piece, you're probably not going to miss anything in the plot. Sure, maybe the film was nominated for 7 Razzies. And hell, it won 3 of them. Worst director, worst screenplay, and worst movie. But you know what? Screw that. I don't care. I dig the movie. And yeah, Megan Fox was nominated for Worst Actress. She's a terrible actress in this movie, but you know what? She provides eye candy for the movie. That's all this film is robots, explosions, fire. Who cares? Yeah, I got worst screenplay. The screenplay's nothing to shake a stick at. But what's its competition in the award category? G.I. Joe Rise of the Cobra? It's another terrible movie I wouldn't mind defending. Great action, kind of silly story, throws me back to when I was a kid and I was playing with my G.I. Joe action figures. Who cares? Throw it on in the background, do get some work. Okay, so maybe that's the third or fourth time I mentioned that it's a movie I like to have in the background while I do work. But you know what? I'm okay with that. Had I gone to the theater and paid 10 bucks to see either G.I. Joe or Transformers 2, I probably would have been a little pissed. That's what DVD and Netflix is great for. You pick it up and you can just have fun with it. I guess what in the end I'm trying to say is let it be a terrible movie. Who cares? Have fun with it. Not everything in the world has to be great. I grew up watching crappy 80s action films, loving every one of them. I remember as a kid digging Cliffhanger. Went back and watched that. You know what? Here's a secret. Terrible movie. Still fun, though. Sure, I would love to see what a different director did with the film, given the fact that we've had so many great comic book movies come out in the last few years here. I think a good director could have handled the property a lot better, and probably given us a lot more serious of a movie that would have had a wider appeal and would have had less people bitching about it. So in conclusion, the movie's all about eye candy. Big cars, big explosion, big toys, beautiful women. Who cares? Have fun with it. And in honor of Transformers 2, here's some Linkin Park to listen to. Ah, fuck it, I'm just kidding. Here's Sex Bob-omb with Threshold from Scott Pilgrim.
We are Sex Bob-omb, and we're here to make you think about death and get sad and stuff!
Typewriter tip 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 karta hai zindagi ki har kahani likhta hai
Typewriter tip 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 karta hai zindagi ki har kahani likhta hai.
Tired of reading lengthy novels without pictures in them to help stimulate your imagination? Why not check out a foreign film that gives you the best of both worlds? You get to read the entire script in subtitles, and you get pretty pictures to look at when you finish reading what they're saying. Most people seem to steer away from foreign films, especially ones with subtitles. And after spending 3 years in Korea watching quite a few, I can see why. Unless you're some sort of genius, it takes more than a second to read the subtitles, and then you miss what's happening on screen. Which is why foreign films, even good ones, usually don't enjoy commercial success outside their country of origin. Unless, of course, they are made by Michael Bay, because, as we all know, he has 8-year-olds write his scripts, and it doesn't take a whiz to read his lines in a second. With that said, I think there is a foreign film worth checking out. Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is a Swedish movie based on a Swedish crime novel by Stig Larsson. I secretly wish I had a sweet name like Stig. But alas, I digress. In Sweden, the novel and subsequent movie is called Men Who Hate Women, and it truly features some men who treat women like most people treat toilet paper. The story revolves around Michael Blomqvist, played by Michael Nyqvist. Blomqvist is a reporter recently convicted of libel, and he has 6 months before he has to report to prison to serve a 3-month sentence. On the day he received his guilty verdict, he is contacted by a lawyer for Henrik Wagner, the aging CEO of the Wagner Group. Henrik apparently knows Blomqvist because when Blomqvist was a boy, his father worked for Wagner, and Henrik believes that 40 years ago, his niece Harriet was murdered at a meeting of the Wagner Group. He believes this to be true because Harriet was his favorite niece, and his family is full of apparent monsters. With 6 months and little waiting for him back in Stockholm, Blomqvist decides to investigate the case. Blomqvist is aided by Lisbeth Salander, who's played by Noomi Rapace. Salander is apparently named for a girl that Larsson, the author of the book, witnessed being gang-raped when he was 15. She has an incredibly tormented past and present with men, and she is on probation for unknown crimes. But she works as a computer hacker, so one would assume that she's on probation for hacker-related crimes. And her character embodies the stereotypical movie female hacker. She's on the fringe, she has tattoos, piercings, jet black hair, and wears more leather than the cast of Sons of Anarchy. She is by far the most interesting character in the movie. After being raped by her probation officer, she videotapes the second rape, then tases him, rapes him, and blackmails him. Best not to cross her, I guess. With the upcoming release of the Hollywood version of the movie, it will be incredibly interesting to see how these scenes are done in that version, Intense and violent rape scenes often give movies an automatic NC-17 rating, which kills movies at the box office. Yet, to remove these scenes from the movie would greatly affect Lisbeth's character development and the tone of the movie as a whole. It's certainly not a very happy movie, but it is good. The girl with the dragon tattoo builds up to a thrilling conclusion filled with guns, explosions, and consensual sex. The tone throughout the film is dark and gloomy, which matches perfectly with the content of the story. With a story like this, you don't want to be looking at sunshine and rainbows while you're watching this. The setting and scenery of the film look incredibly familiar, as though it was shot in our own backyard, while the buildings seem very foreign. However, not nearly as foreign as the dialogue. Yet a few words do sound familiar, but not familiar enough to turn off the subtitles, unless of course you know Swedish. The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is highly watchable and enjoyable, but it's probably not the best movie for a first date. So, with that said, the movie's available on DVD and Netflix. Check it out.
This is Evan, and a couple weeks ago, Ashley and I, from yet another gaming show, we were down in lovely Carroll Stream, Illinois, for the Chicagoland Entertainment Collectors Expo, which is a really long way of saying a whole bunch of celebrities in one area, mostly a Holiday Inn, and just hanging out and talking to each other. And we were lucky enough to talk to a couple people, and we'll be doing some of their interviews, the highlights of those interviews in just a second. We've got a couple of people from Star Wars. We've got Bonnie Peace, who played Aunt Beru in episodes 2 and 3. She talks to us a little bit about those movies and her new album. We've also got Gerald Holm, who played Tessic or Squidface in episode 6, as well as doing stuff with like Little Shop of Horrors, and just a very cool guy. We also talked to Carolyn Monroe, one-time Bond girl, as well as a regular on Hammer Horror Films. If you've never heard of Hammer Horror, shame on you, for one thing. But it was a great kind of not quite schlocky horror outfit based out of London in the 60s and 70s. And we talked to her a bit, too. Now, these are all the highlights. I ended up cutting down about an hour or so interviews down to about 15, 20 minutes. So all of those plus more will be available on our YouTube page. If you just go to youtube.com/fancypantsgangsters, you can find all the video for that as well as the audio. Complete uncut interviews for those guys as well as other people we talked to, and very exciting stuff. So I guess without further ado, here's a bunch of interviews we did at the Chicagoland Entertainment Collectors Expo. I'm sitting here with Caroline Monroe. Of many different things. It's kind of weird. Like, you know, to some people you're a Bond girl. To other people you're a Hammer Horror person.
Right.
You know, and
I've been around.
You've been around. Right. Well, you know, I knew I'd recognized you, and I couldn't remember where. And then I realized that you played Dr. Five's wife. I think you're the only actor I've ever seen that has done a recurring role in which you don't speak either time.
Not a word, not a dicky bird. I always think, Evan, that it was because of the continuity that they had to have me in for the next one, really. I don't know, but and that was an honor to work with Vincent Price. It's sad that we didn't share any dialogue scenes, though, but he was wonderful. Just to lie next to him in the coffin was an honor.
What was it like to work for Hammer in that time? Because you're dealing with, you know, big stars. I mean, Vincent Price, Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing, but they were fairly low budget and, you know, very quickly shot. Kind of what was the atmosphere like shooting those movies?
It was actually terrific because of the low budgets and the and the length of time. Not like the luxury of time that films have today, you know, big movies, big budgets. We had maybe 4 weeks shoot, maybe six was quite a bigger budget. But no, 4 weeks and you got it done. The hours were long and hard, but you worked as a team. I think maybe the answer would be teamwork, you know, mm-hmm. teamwork. And it was Sir Michael and James Carreras would choose their actors,
mm-hmm.
and they would very often work with the same crew.
Yeah, it was very much kind of like a repertory kind of group.
This is the way they did it. You had fabulous cinematographers, brilliant directors, and the actors were pretty good too. So
kind of on the opposite side of the cult film spectrum was your work with James Bond.
Yeah.
Obviously, yes. The Spy Who Loved Me. Favorite Bond? For you?
Well, it has to be Roger. That is my Bond. Everybody says they're Bond. Of course they do, because those are the ones they work with.
Mm-hmm.
But Sean was the first, and Sean was magnificent. But mm-hmm. Roger has a special place in my heart. Having said that, I mean, you've got the newer Bonds. You mm-hmm. come up right to Daniel Craig, who I think is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a throwback to Connery.
You think so?
Yeah, I think he has the toughness and the ruthlessness, and he's very sexy, and you can imagine that he could be a killer.
Mm-hmm.
To me, he could be. To be on the set of The Spy Who Loved Me was quite amazing to start off with. Your imagination ran wild because we were in Sardinia. We were lucky enough to go to Sardinia, and we were staying in a beautiful, owned by the Aga Khan, and it was a wonderful hotel that he owned. The weather was rotten. We had not good weather. It was not typically Sardinian weather, but you looked outside your window in the morning and you had the speedboats and the helicopters, and so you became in your Bond frame of head. But actually, I think it first dawned on me that it was quite a big deal when we had all the European press flown into the set in Sardinia, and Roger, we were trying out the wet bike, what do they call them now? The jet skis.
Jet skis, yeah.
Jet ski. It was the first time it had ever been used, this wet bike.
Mm-hmm.
It was it's a kind of premiere outing, and it was like the world's press descended, and poor Roger was doing a valiant job trying to ride this thing that, you know, only the stuntmen had ridden,
mm-hmm.
and I sat on the back. So suddenly I thought, oh yeah, that's, you know, this is quite
There's something going on,
yes.
With this. Who has the crazier fans, the James Bond stuff or the Hammer horror people?
Crazier or more?
Maybe not crazier, but more intensely, like, into that stuff, like more excited,
yeah,
to see people involved with it.
I know what you mean. Yes, both, really.
Really.
Both Bond fans are true, you know, true diehard Bond fans, and they know every bit of dialogue, every bit of costume, every location. It's amazing. And horror fans, Hammer fans, or fantasy fans, again, they know their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This is the scary thing. They know more than we do about, you know, the dialogue and the settings and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to say, I think you lot, you know, if it wasn't for you lot, if you're watching out there, we wouldn't be doing what we do. We wouldn't be doing what we're doing. You know, we wouldn't be here and enjoying mm-hmm. this lovely city and the people and everything. So I just say thank you to you.
Where can people see you? I mean, do you have any other conventions planned to do, or just any sort of appearances or...
Various bits. I mean, I'm coming back over to the States. I've got in next year, I've got, Wonderfest. I'm coming to Wonderfest. And I'm doing Monster Bash. Is it the
Excellent.
Monster Bash? Which should be great. Both of us, Martine and I.
Oh, great.
Double act.
Great.
We get on really well. So we're both coming to both those shows. So early next year. And I did a film end of last year, and it was a very interesting bunch of characters. We had, it was one of David Carradine's last. So it was, David was in it, Michael Madsen, Daryl Hannah, Patrick Bergen. We had an amazing cast.
Wow.
And we each did cameos. It was shot in England, and it's a 3D, and it's called El Dorado.
Okay.
So goodness knows what it's like, but it should be interesting just for the cast alone.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the movie, like what it's about, or?
Slightly, well, very much spoofy, I would say, blues brothery based. You know, these two brothers traveling and all the characters they meet. So
all right.
That's it.
And that, it's a British production?
British, yes. British
okay.
Production.
Excellent. Well, unless there's something you want to make sure that people know about, you know, before we take off here.
Not really.
No?
Just, I just want to say thank you. You know, it's great, and I can't believe I'm still doing these things, and thank you very much for supporting me.
Well, there's no better way to end than that. Oh. Again, we've been sitting here with Carolyn Monroe, James Bond, Hammer Horror, tons of great movies, but check out these movies. We'll have a link to not only your website but also your IMDb page so people can find the movies, because I'm sure most of them are available via Netflix or something like that, so people can check out these movies.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
I am standing, or sitting, I suppose, with Bonnie. Now, help me with the last, is it just Piace?
Peace.
Now, you are known, you're one of the many Star Wars people here,
mm-hmm.
and you are known from episodes 2 and 3 as Aunt Beru.
Yep.
When you got the job, did anyone tell you that, yeah, by the way, you're now a Star Wars person for life?
You know, some of my friends did say that, and I was like, yeah. But I didn't really know what they meant. And actually, like, it is 10 years later now, and still I'm meeting Star Wars fans all the time. It seems to be true. I couldn't actually, like, ask for a Star Wars audition. They were shooting in Sydney, and they basically have to come and find you and offer you an audition. So it's not like I was going, I want to be in Star Wars. It had crossed my mind, I suppose, because I knew that it was shooting there.
Mm-hmm.
But it was out of the blue, like, when I got the call saying I had an audition. So that was pretty cool. I was just doing acting.
Have you been approached to do anything, either, you know, animated or for the TV show or anything like that?
I haven't, but as it appears for me, they don't give you that much notice. So, like, for episode 3, I remember they were shooting in Sydney, and I went to LA, and I called them before I went. I was like, I know you guys are shooting, and I'm wondering if you want me to be in the movie and whether I should stay. And they're like, no, go to LA. And then sure enough, I got a call saying, we need you here in 3 days. So it's like, you never know.
What is it like shooting a Star Wars film? It seems like a pretty surreal experience.
It kind of was. Like, for me, my character obviously didn't have all the crazy makeup, so I did look like myself. But even that, like, even though I had my hair in buns and I had, like, a bit of a tan and I had the Star Wars outfit and stuff, so I looked at myself in the mirror after I came out of makeup and wardrobe, and I was like, oh, my gosh, I look like I'm in Star Wars. It was weird. I can't imagine what it would be like for someone who's, like, in the makeup chair for 5 hours and then they come out looking like an alien.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be pretty fun.
Nice. What has been your experience with the Star Wars fans? I mean, is it just a function of, oh, you were... You know, you were Aunt Beru, okay, whatever. Or is it like, oh my God, you were Aunt Beru? Like, is there? I mean, I imagine that there is a, like, that's really cool. But is there? I guess what is the difference, or how have you gauged the fan reaction to someone when it's clear to them that you were in Star Wars?
Yeah, I mean, it ranges from people who kind of think that I look somewhat familiar, but they don't know where I'm from, to people who are like, you raised Luke Skywalker. So, I love that. I love being able to say I raised Luke Skywalker.
Well, we can talk a little bit about the album here. You mentioned it. Now, is it available now?
Not yet. It's you can hear some of it on myspace.com/Bonniepiece.
Okay.
So BonniePiece. But it will be up in the next couple of months.
Where, aside from the music, I mean, you're still a working actress.
Yeah, you know, I took a break for a few years, but getting back into it now. And I just did a short film with Tom Holland, who did all the, like, the Chucky movie and stuff.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that was pretty cool.
Do you like doing, I guess, quote-unquote, more genre films, like sci-fi and horror and things like that, or...
I really love sci-fi. I kind of, in the beginning, I wasn't a huge sci-fi fan, but I have become a huge sci-fi fan because I think it's fascinating, all the concepts and stuff that come up. Like, I am a Star Wars fan now, and I love the whole idea of the universe and the Force and everything. I really want to get into period pieces as well, actually. I think it would be fun.
That's not an uncommon thing that I hear from people that do Star Wars movies, where they come into it not a sci-fi fan, but they end up just loving, you know, either sci-fi in general or Star Wars specifically.
Yeah.
What do you think is about that Star Wars universe that seems to appeal to people, that it seems to be that kind of gateway into sci-fi for a lot of people? Why do you think that is?
I think there's something really specific about Star Wars in the sense that, you know, there's the whole heroic journey. And I think that we each as human beings have that anyway, so it resonates with something kind of at our core. So there's the heroic journey, and then there's also, like, the Force and all the magic and all the amazing, exciting things within that, and the idea of traveling from planet to planet, and it's a whole universe.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure what it is, but definitely it's encapsulated a whole human journey within that.
If George Lucas calls you up like while we're doing this interview and says you have to be back in Sydney in 24 hours, you would still do it?
Sure, George.
I'm sure he's listening. So you know, she is available, and the show only goes till 3, so you could be on a flight by like 4:30.
Sounds good.
So excellent. So, and we'll have links to that on our website as well as in the show notes for Film Army. Is there anything that I miss that you definitely want people to know, either about you or about, you know, Star Wars or any just philosophy? I don't even care. Is there anything you want to make sure that people know before we wrap up here?
Oh, geez. Out of everything, let's all try to be kind to each other and make it a beautiful world.
I got nothing to add to that, so we'll leave you with that. Bonnie Peace here from Star Wars, and what's the name of the album?
The Deep End.
The Deep End, mm-hmm. Available soon at your friendly local music shop. Stay tuned for that as well. So thank you, Bonnie, for sitting down with us. We're talking with Gerald Holm. You're kind of, I was looking through your career. Now, in terms of Star Wars, you're much more known for two main characters, the quote-unquote Mon Calamari officer, not Admiral Ackbar,
mm-hmm.
but you're one of the sub-officers.
Absolutely, yeah.
And as well as Tessic Squidhead. Now, is that the official name on that one?
Okay, long story. When we filmed in 1982, he was called Squidface.
Squidface, okay.
Okay, didn't have a proper name then. As things happen in the Star Wars universe, when an action figure was brought out 20 years later, he was given a backstory, and he was given a new name. And the name he was given then was Squidhead.
Squidhead.
Tessic.
Okay.
Tessic. When the original vintage action figure came out in 1983, it was Squidhead. But when we were filming, he was usually called Squidface.
Squidface.
When you see the face, you understand why he was called all those names.
First off, did you guys, as you were shooting this, now you're obviously shooting the third movie in the series, so by then there was a bit of the fandom and things like that, but did you realize that at the time that this was going to be such a big part of your life at that point?
Okay, now there are about 3 questions in there.
Okay, I'm sorry.
So let's go, no, I love it. But let's go back in history to the first part. When we auditioned, we were told that we were auditioning to play characters in the court of this new gangster called Jabba,
okay.
who was the most evil guy in the galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
We were supposed to be heavily featured with him, right? Which is why we were hired as mime artists. We were on the same contracts as the performers, mm-hmm. as the actors, exactly the same performing contracts. But we're in the cast list and in the credits of the film as mime artists.
Okay.
If you have a look at Ewoks, it's, you know, 3 million Ewoks.
Yeah.
9 mime artists. And we were hired to bring to life the creatures of Jabba's palace. And also some of us were told we were going to be playing something called Calamari Men.
Okay.
That's what we knew at the time.
Yep.
And we knew that the people with Jabba, the gangsters, were dark side. And we knew the other characters were light side. And we knew that we were going to be some of the few performers in Star Wars history who had played both. So you're talking to someone who played both light side and dark side. Not many people did that. So that's the first part of your question.
Okay.
We weren't supposed to be minor characters. We were supposed to be heavily featured in scenes with Jabba. In fact, we started rehearsing 2 days before filming started on Jabba's throne room.
Okay.
We started rehearsing on a Friday and a Saturday, filming on the Monday. And we worked out lots of business.
Mm-hmm.
I particularly worked with Claire Davenport, who played the fat dancer.
Okay,
you know,
yep.
With the 6... What should we call them? Breasts?
Yeah, it's the internet. You can call them whatever you want.
Okay. No, I'll call them breasts.
Okay, that works.
You can fill in the blanks.
Yeah, sure.
We worked out a lot of stuff together, none of which was filmed.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Jabba set wasn't that big.
Okay.
Right? It was not that big. When you get crew, carpenters, electrician, makeup people, painters, fly boy, best boy, you know... dressers, wardrobe people, not to mention the actors, the cast, the extras, the production people, you know, 150 people or something on set.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened? We sort of disappeared into the background.
Wow.
So that's, you know, when you say minor characters, that's what happened. Mm-hmm. We disappeared. Now, for many, many years, I was sort of embarrassed by that.
Okay.
You know, and I didn't, it wasn't on my CV.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still a working actor. It wasn't on my CV for many years that I did. Until... fans started to track me down. And what they started to say was, what I liked about Tessic Squidhead was that you were always in the background. And You know, one fan said, I used to sit there thinking, what's he plotting? What's he planning? He's obviously scheming something. Look at the way he's playing with his tentacles. He's obviously got some scheme. So then I started to see it from the fan point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, fans know much more about everything than mere actors.
Not only are you a voice actor, but you're doing the puppeteering. And both of those seem to be, you know, actors, there's a million of them. But with puppeteers and voice actors, it seems like there's a very small group of maybe, you know, a few dozen people that seem to work on every movie. And you mentioned just in that last little bit, all these people that were also worked on Star Wars and things like that. As a side question, is that just a function of how hard that work is, or is it just not enough people are interested in doing it?
Another brilliant question. Okay, some history. Way back in 1978, my first actor job when I left drama school was with a children's theater called Polka. Polka Children's Theatre.
Okay.
And I toured for a year with them. And they used puppets. Okay, now at drama school you're taught mime and dance and sword fighting, all the things you will need in your career.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not taught puppetry.
So really?
I had to learn puppetry. And they taught us rod puppets and glove puppets and marionettes and shadow puppets. You see, I'm still doing it. 30
yeah,
years
yeah,
later,
you're still doing it. Yeah.
I can still do the hands and everything. So I had to learn how to be a puppeteer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the best puppeteers, this is why this director used actors and not puppeteers. Because the best puppeteers are actors.
Oh.
And they will watch. If you watch a puppeteer, for example, on The Muppets, I don't know if you've ever seen behind-the-scenes footage.
There's a monitor
on the floor, and the puppeteer will be watching the monitor.
Mm-hmm.
So he's seeing what the camera's seeing. And they will be acting with the puppet.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're not doing... one of the things I had to do 32 years ago, oh, what a beautiful morning, oh, what a beautiful day. You know, I'm not dissociated from the puppet. It would be, oh, what a beautiful morning. Do you know?
Yeah.
I would be acting not with the puppet, through the puppet. So acting was going through it. So whenever you see... Of course, when you're watching, you don't see me, but you see my performance.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's me you're watching.
Yep.
So, that's how I learned my puppetry. People who followed me were people like Don Austin, who went on to be Yoda in the prequels, one of the prequels.
Okay.
A lot of puppet actors went to this place, learned puppeteering, then went to Henson's, they worked at Henson's, and they stayed being puppeteers.
I'm kind of looking at your website and things like that, and you're still very active when you're not doing all these conventions. What can people find you in now?
Okay, well, I did a couple of movies last year. Big, big Hollywood movies, made in London. Almost impossible for actors like me, unless you're Ewan McGregor, to even get seen for them, you know? And I think I've done a ton of theatre, a ton of commercials, a ton of television. But I never had an audition for a film since Little Shop of Horrors in 1986.
Mm-hmm.
All these years later, you know? And I had auditions twice last year, and I got both jobs.
Nice.
And one of them is called Chat Room.
Okay.
It's directed by a man many Star Wars fans know called Hideo Nakata, who directed The Ring.
Oh, okay, yes.
The horror, horror.
Yep.
This is not Japanese horror. This is sort of a psychological thriller.
Okay.
It's about a group of kids who meet online, encourage each other to do bad things. Starring Aaron Johnson, who you might know as Kick-Ass.
Oh, okay. Yep.
He played Kick-Ass. Up-and-coming cast of young British talent.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a joy to work with Nakata. Tiny part, it's over in a flash, but I just loved it. And working with this genius, Hideo Nakata, is just a gift.
Well, hopefully people are watching online or watching the video later. They will memorize your face. And keep looking out for you when they go and see the movie.
Just don't look at your popcorn, or you might miss me.
Oh, okay.
but the other one I must tell you about was Total Hollywood, made in London, directed by a guy called William Monaghan, who won an Oscar a few years ago for a film directed by Scorsese, Jack Nicholson star, Leonardo DiCaprio.
Oh, The Departed.
Well done.
Yep.
Absolutely. Boston Man.
It's
about the Boston Irish gangsters.
Yep.
Oh, genius. Genius man. This is his first, this is his debut as a director. And I play Keira Knightley stars in it, Star Wars actress. Brilliant. She's just, and she's so hot at the moment. I think she filmed her part in 9 days or something.
Oh, really?
It's called London Boulevard. And it's a modern take on Sunset Boulevard. But the reclusive actress. But instead of being an old one, she's a young one. Colin Farrell co-stars. I have a scene in the cemetery with him. I'm Undertaker.
Nice.
Undertaker. Again, very small part, but what a gift. You know? Mm-hmm. After all these years as an actor, mm-hmm. you get these gifts. Nice. So they're both released this year.
Okay, so they're both released in America this year, or
I believe
they're
so.
London? Okay.
Well, certainly London Boulevard is being released on the 15th of October in Britain.
Okay. Your parting words for today.
Well first of all, even people who look at my website sometimes come away and they still don't know that I had two pages of dialogue as the Mon Calamari officer that we shot that wasn't used. They were shot as an experiment to see what it was like, Akbar talking with a fellow Mon Cal. My mouth wasn't articulated for speech, so I wasn't surprised it wasn't used.
Okay.
But there's very good information. You can download those two pages from my website.
Oh, okay.
Or from one of the interviews on my Wikipedia page,
mm-hmm.
along with two call sheets. If Star Wars fans have looked at my site and missed those, I urge you to go back and see them because it's stuff you like mm-hmm. to read. I know it is. And if I can give you an example, one of the lines I had as a Mon Cal officer. What was it? Sir, the shield around the Death Star has lost power. Obviously, I didn't say it like that. I acted it. But that's vital information.
Oh, yeah.
And if you take that out, there's a hole in the script.
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell me what replaced that? What line replaced
it? Oh, man.
The shield is down. Now, everybody knows that line. The shield is down. Who said it?
Not you.
No. Well, some people... Let me give you a clue. Some people said Akbar. Some people said Lando Calrissian. The answer is nobody said it. It's a voice off.
Oh.
But they make it look like it's Akbar's mouth, but it's not.
Oh, really?
There's a quick glimpse of Akbar, as if to say, suggesting
that he's saying it.
And you believe he said it, but he didn't. And to me, that says that there's a little hole, there's a black hole in the plot.
Mm-hmm.
And they filled it by a voice off.
Well, I'm going to have to rewatch the movie now. Keep an eye out for it. Wow.
And that's it. Final thing I'd have to say?
Sure.
May the force be with you. What else can I say?
We've got nowhere else to go after that. So, again, I've been talking with Gerald Holm. Keep listening to the Film Army. We've got more after this.
Thank you so much.
It's October, and we're smack dab in the middle of one of the greatest seasons of the year. No, not fall. You gotta be kidding, right? I mean, who wants to watch a bunch of dumb leaves turn color? I'd rather watch paint dry than waste my time with that garbage. Besides, they just end up falling off the trees, constantly filling up your yard, giving you yet another chore your wife wants you to do this weekend. And I'm certainly not excited for school to be back in session. Bunch of back-to-school sale commercials flooding the airwaves? And getting stuck behind school buses in rush hour traffic? Come on, who needs that? I'm talking about football season. That's right. It's the time of year where every Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday somewhere in America, there's a football game being played. I, along with a majority of the country, watch countless hours of one of the best dramas in history unfold right there on the gridiron. What better way to celebrate this blessed time of year than to talk about a heralded genre of movies? Football films. The inspirational montages, the insurmountable odds, the swelling score, the slow clap. I mean, what's not to love? I will be your tour guide to some of the greatest football movies of all time. So let's break it down. Everybody, take a knee, and we'll find out who made the roster. Back in high school, one of my favorite sounds was the roar of the home crowd on a Friday night, where classmates, peers, and friends were elevated to something greater, where they put their family struggles and history homework aside for a couple of hours to bang heads on the field of competition. So it's only appropriate to discuss a few of the films that best describe the experience of prep football. First up is Friday Night Lights, a 2004 film that documents the coach and players of a high school football team and the Texas city of Odessa that supports and is obsessed with them. Directed by Peter Berg, this adaptation of H.G. Bissinger's nonfiction account of the Permian Panthers' 1988 run at the state championship is one of the most accurate portrayals of the trials and tribulations of a high-pressured high school football team. The movie stars Billy Bob Thornton as coach Gary Gaines, who is firmly in the hot seat after overusing their star running back to the tune of a season-ending ACL injury. Tim McGraw also plays a supporting role as the alcoholic-slash-abusive father of the Panthers' fullback. He turns in a fine performance as a former state champion who puts his son under immense pressure to perform. The way the film was shot is amazingly intimate, and the outcome, like life, isn't entirely a happy ending. If you pay close enough attention, you'll notice Dallas Cowboys wide receiver and real-life former Permian Panther Roy Williams playing as an assistant coach for the opposing team. Also, Denver Bronco corner Ty Law plays a wide receiver for the team the Permian Panthers face at the state championship. Now to move on to a less serious but immensely entertaining movie about football at the high school level. I'm talking about Varsity Blues. This 1999 movie created one of the greatest sports villains of all time, Coach Bud Kilmer, played masterfully by John Voight. As long as there have been sports to play, there have been coaches who are so hell-bent on victory they will push/torture their own players to do it. But this film also takes place in Texas, this time in West Canaan, where the main character is Jonathan Mox Moxon, played by James Vanderbeek, who is the backup quarterback for the West Canaan Coyotes. Under the reign of Bud Kilmer, they have a sterling record. In his 30-year tenure, the team has won 22 district championships. This year, Kilmer intends to make it 23, and he thinks he has the players to do so, starting with his star quarterback, Lance Harbor, played by Paul Walker. Unfortunately, the coach's need to win has become an obsession, and it causes him to push his players into doing unsafe things, like taking drugs to numb pain. When Lance goes down with a serious injury, Mox has to step into the breach. He soon finds himself torn between his sudden celebrity status and his desire to stage an uprising against the coach. Sure, the story dips into some mediocre melodrama and is probably better known for lowbrow moments like Allie Larder's whipped cream bikini scene or the sex ed teacher who moonlights as an exotic dancer. But us football fans know authentic football action when we see it. And the scenes that take place on the field in this film are some of the best of any movie on this list. The next movie in the list might be my favorite football movie through and through. I'm talking about the 1993 movie highlighting a season of fictional college football program, the ESU Timberwolves, who deal with the big pressure to make it to a bowl game. That's right, I'm talking about The Program. The movie has plenty of Hollywood talent, including James Caan as Coach Sam Winters, as well as Halle Berry, Omar Epps, and Christy Swanson. The movie details many issues that face a team of collegiate athletes who are treated like high-paid professionals. I'm talking mainly alcohol and drug abuse, general college life, and steroids. Holy cow, steroids. Anytime anyone even mentions steroids, I get visions of this movie. Particularly Latimer, who is obviously taking performance-enhancing drugs as he goes from a backup to a starter on defense in one season. The guy gains 30 pounds of muscle in the offseason. Maybe the best scene of the movie involves Latimer's roid rage celebration after making his first start for the Timberwolves. Well, what do you think, Latimer?
I think we ought to tell Coach.
I don't know. You don't want to know about this.
Make sure you tell Latimer that the NCAA will be tested on Saturday. Starting defense!
By the way, that crashing sound is him putting his head through several car windows, which is a completely appropriate response to that good news, I'm sure. The movie also discusses the pressure of being a Heisman candidate at the beginning of the season, as quarterback Joe Kane responds accordingly by getting into a bar fight and getting a DUI, landing him in rehab. Another movie that features some exciting football scenes, which, as you have likely figured out by now, is like catnip for football fans. We're suckers for movies that feature a good pep talk in the huddle, and few of those speeches amp you up better than this one.
Alright, let's take it to him now. Trips right, motion, Z3. Let's put the women and children to bed and go looking for dinner, boys. On four, ready? Right!
Turning from action to drama, I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up the amazing 1971 made-for-TV movie Brian Song, which also stars James Caan, as well as Billy Dee Williams.
There are two rules to remember if you want to have a good time. Rule number one, never run out of Colt 45. Rule number two, never forget rule number one.
Yes, that Billy Dee Williams. Now, this film tells the courageous true story of Chicago Bears teammates Brian Piccolo and Gale Sayers. It's drama that can only be scripted by God himself. We have a white man and a black man competing for the same position on a professional sports team in a time of heightened racial tension. These guys should have been sworn enemies, but they ended up growing into one of the best friendships ever told on film. The film itself is based on Gale Sayers' account of their friendship and his coping with Brian Piccolo's illness in the autobiography I Am Third. This is the quintessential tearjerker. It's the kind of movie where, if you aren't moved by it, you're either a robot or have a heart made of the blackest of coal. And I'm not one for sappy movies, but I didn't have the heart to cut this one from my roster. Another film that could be considered at least partially a sap fest that made my roster was 1996's Jerry Maguire, written and directed by Cameron Crowe. Tom Cruise plays the title role as a successful sports agent who suffers a nervous breakdown due to a guilty conscience and writes a brutally honest mission statement condemning the unethical nature of his business. This results in his termination, but leads him to take on a controversial client, Arizona Cardinals wide receiver Rod Tidwell, which was played by Cuba Gooding Jr. and won the Academy Award. The film's best scenes are where Maguire is dealing with Tidwell and all of his baggage. The relationship between agent and athlete is rarely known to the public, and this movie does a decent job exposing the difficulty of having a conscience while trying to succeed in the sports industry. Although this movie's legacy seems to be all the catchphrases it produced.
I love black people!
I love black people!
What you gonna do, Jerry?
Show me the money!
Help me help you.
You know, some dudes might have the coin, but they'll never have the quan. You complete me.
You had me at hello.
This movie sticks out in my mind as a terrific balance between chick flick and sports movie. Not to mention all the sports cameos you'd expect from a mid-90s movie. The one nagging thought I have regarding this movie is that Drew Rosenhaus watched this film and he actually saw himself as Jerry Maguire. I mean, when the good Lord knows he's more of a Bob Sugar.
That's my job. Remember the names of skanks that you bang on the road. That's what I do. It's not about the money. I do it all for you.
Talking about money, ho!
What a dick. So, there you have it. My whole, full roster of the greatest football movies of all time. Wait, I didn't miss any, did I?
Rudy.
What's that?
Rudy. Rudy. Rudy.
Oh, Christ, I forgot about that one. I should really write these down. All right. The most inspirational football movie of all time, which I forgot from this list, I guess, is 1993 movie Rudy. I mean, this one is the ultimate underdog story. Daniel Rudy Rudiger from Joliet, Illinois, son of a steel mill worker, decides that despite his poor grades and limited athletic ability, he is destined to play football for the Notre Dame Fighting Irish. 3 years after graduating high school and after the death of his best friend, Rudy decides to make his dream a reality through his patented work ethic and tremendous heart. The film takes you through all the obstacles that stand in between Rudy and that iconic gold helmet of the Irish. The film is very entertaining, and if you look closely, you'll see a very young Vince Vaughn and Jon Favreau, who would go on to make many movies together, including Swingers and Maid. But nothing beats the climax of this movie. The ending scene, where Rudy finally gets to suit up for his last eligible football game and is allowed on the field for the final snap, where the music swells, Rudy, in all of his glory, sacks the quarterback. Now, the play itself is meaningless in terms of the outcome of the game, but the way the teammates give back to Rudy for his hard work and efforts for the team off the field is nothing short of inspiring. I mean, listen to this music. It's hard not to get inspired when you've got this in the background. I should have this play during my meetings at work. It'd bring a little much-needed encouragement to this office. Okay. Now my roster is complete. Go forth and watch football movies. Let the winning spirit of the football season also be part of your movie watching experience.
While October is a month of beautiful foliage and harvest celebration, it also heralds the coming of cold. What better way to combat the cold than staying indoors with a warm bowl of popcorn and Netflix? You can get a free 2-week trial just by going to bit.ly/FPGflicks, all the while helping support the Film Army in its mission of movie netcast domination. We also welcome you to our Facebook page at facebook.com/FilmArmyFPG and at Twitter at twitter.com/FilmArmyFPG. We also welcome comments and submissions on our email at FilmArmy@FancyPantsGangsters.com or via carrier pigeon. Standard rates apply. Until next time, courageous listener, good luck, Godspeed, and keep watching movies.